and turned the TV off, which I was glad about. Who could watch those things, really, and not laugh or weep? I always envisioned the girls coming home from those jobs, their heels click-clicking back to two warm apartment vestibules, to dented mailboxes with only bills in them, the girls' first names in different initials. He was trying to tell me something, renting those movies. Why didn't I listen? Once again, I feel a movement in my stomach, a nausea. I go upstairs quickly and vomit in the hall bathroom. After I flush and turn on the cold water to wash my face, I hear knocking at the door. I open it to find Travis, his eyes squinting in the light. "Are you sick?" I reach down to hug him, kiss his cheek. "No, I'm okay, honey. Go back to bed." I watch him start back toward his bedroom, then call, "Travis, were you sleeping till now? Did you just wake up?" "Yeah," he says sleepily. "Okay, good night." What could I have been thinking? What if Travis had come downstairs? "What are you doing, Mom?" he would have asked. "Gross." I would have pulled away quickly, fingered the button at the top of my silk blouse, blushing furiously, and David would have zipped up fast, covering his uncooperative penis that had lain in his lap like a grub worm. Actually, maybe it wouldn't have been so bad to be discovered. At least then David would have been embarrassed, too. I gently close Travis's door and go into my bedroom, sit on the bed for a long moment. Then I remove my wedding rings and put them in my jewelry box. So many others have done this. I am not the only one. I am not the only one. But here, I am the only one. I go down the hall and into Lydia's room, turn on her bedside light. It's a comforting space, a white afghan folded over a chair, a hardback book with a faded blue cover lying on the footstool, bookmark in place, a faint smell of lilac. I look around, feeling only a little guilty. There are photographs on the dresser, gold and silver frames on a white lace runner. I pick up one of Thomas, hold it under the lamplight to see it better. He must have been a very handsome man in his prime. His eyes are still an arresting blue, his gaze steady and direct. His ears are large, and they stick out just a little. Probably they used to embarrass him, but they seem distinguished to me, senator-like. I also like Thomas's white mustache and the deep wrinkles in his forehead, reminding me of the beautiful lines you've seen from an airplane window etched in the earth. It is such an intimate history I see here on Thomas's forehead. This is worth something, isn't it? Maybe I should consider dating much older men. What's it like to love an 80-year-old? When Thomas and Lydia go to bed together, and I know they do, what's it like? It must be so slow. It must be so exquisitely tender. I imagine a gentle old hand on my neck sliding down my back, acknowledging each vertebra. I would not be bothered by any of his age spots. I would let in an older lover's touch like sunshine on a winter day. Yes, I would. And with an old lover, I could feel so young. "You're so beautiful," he would say to me, oblivious of my recent need to hold small print away from myself. "My darling," he would say. I pull Thomas's photo closer, close my eyes, open them to the blurry sight of his smile. I kiss it. Then I sigh, wipe my marks off the glass, put the picture carefully back on Lydia's dresser. Oh, I envy Lydia her whole correct life, drinking tea out of her blue and white bone china cup every morning, dressed for the day in a wool skirt and white blouse, a pin with an elegant luster at her throat. She has a woman friend named Catherine who visits her regularly, who always wears a hat and gloves with her dark coat, button galoshes last time, too. Defense against an early, thin layer of snow. She carries an old-fashioned purse, and I love when she reaches in to get her hanky or compact or her candies in their flowered tin. I imagine a heavy fountain pen in that purse, the ink a peacock blue. I imagine an address book with gold-trimmed pages, each entry done in perfect Palmer script. A jeweled pillbox, a tortoiseshell comb. No daytimer. No mace. Catherine and Lydia have been friends for more than 60 years, Lydia told me, exchanging recipes and childcare and patterns for padded shoulder suits in their early years, now going to museums and flower shows, to downtown department stores to share sandwiches for lunch, and to hospitals to visit friends, or occasionally each other. Outside, I see a vein of lightning stab the sky, and then I hear the low rumble of thunder. A wonderful sound when you're in bed with someone you love. I watch the rain come down, hear how the sound changes from tapping to drumming. The urgency. It should be snow, but for this freakish run of warm weather, it would be snow. I wish it were. I wish the season would change definitively. I slip off my shoes and lie down on Lydia's bed, turn out the light, pull her beautiful rose-colored quilt over myself. I will sleep here, wrapped in the comfort of someone else's life, far away from those rings I left behind me. I lie still, my hands folded across my stomach, listening to the anchoring sound of my own breathing. Sheets of water cascade down the window. Inside this house, now suddenly too big, my boy and I lie down in our separate places and give ourselves over to the quiet repair of sleep. Outside, the sky weeps and weeps, or so it seems to me. Times like this, everything in the world becomes personal. Chapter 10. It takes me a few days to tell Rita what happened. And when I do, she is her usual Sagittarius self. "I can't believe you made such a fool of yourself," she says. "Oh, I shouldn't have told you. I knew I shouldn't tell you. I don't need recriminations now. I need support. I can't support you in something so stupid. What are you begging him for? Getting rid of him will be good for you." "Yeah, it's been great so far." I get out of bed, slide my feet into my slippers. "I have to go. I have to get dressed." "It's noon there. I'm well aware of that. I thought you were getting dressed first thing these days." "That didn't last. Martha Stewart is crazy." "Well, we all know that. I don't know why you would ever take a suggestion from her in the first place. Everything she tells people is just a setup for failure. She's a misanthrope." I open my closet, look for something to wear. "I don't think Martha's so bad. I think I want her for a friend instead of you. When I look at her magazine, I feel soothed. When I talk to you, I feel like hanging myself." "All right, listen. Listen to me. I would not be your friend if I didn't say this to you. I don't feel sorry for a victim who keeps choosing to be a victim. That's what you're doing. You're not even trying. You're just sinking deeper and deeper into feeling sorry for yourself." "No, I'm not." "Yes, I am." "Have you looked for a job yet?" "No." "Yes." "I asked at the nursing home, and they said they didn't need anyone. Then I looked in the paper, and everything was too hard." "Well, get a job." "What can I do? Who's going to hire a 42-year-old woman whose only job experience is singing in a band?" "A lot of people would." "I have to go. I'm late for a lunch."
"You are?"
"Don't get excited. It's with my mother."
"Oh, great. That'll help you right out."
"Well, Louise called. She told me Mom sounded like a wreck when she talked to her last week. She wants me to check up on her. I've been kind of ignoring her."
"Why doesn't Louise check up on her?"
"Let's see now. Could it be that I live in Massachusetts and Louise lives in Montana?"
"Well, don't stay there long. She'll make you crazier."
"I suppose."
"Call me later tonight."
"What for?"
"Just do."
"You call me. I don't want to spend the money."
"David is still supporting you."
"I know, but I don't want to take any more money from him than I have to."
"Well, there you are. That's the kind of thinking you need to be doing."
I hang up, go into the bathroom to wash my face. I feel like I just got a fake A. I'm not interested in saving David money. I'm interested in being mean to Rita.
"Honey," my mother says sadly, "look at you."
We are sitting at my mother's kitchen table, chicken salad sandwiches before us that have been cut into fours and anchored together with confetti-topped toothpicks. She is objecting to my unwashed hair and my outfit, a pajama top over gray sweatpants. She herself is wearing a sheer white blouse tucked into black and white checked pants and a red cardigan sweater, earrings that are cherries. "I'll change before Travis gets home. Don't worry about it. I just worked out." She doesn't bother to call me a liar. I bite into my sandwich, pull a grape out of my mouth, and fling it onto the plate.
"What are you doing?" she asks, frowning.
"I don't like grapes and chicken salad."
"Well, it happens to be good."
"You know, all through school you put butter on my meat sandwiches, and I told you I didn't like butter on my meat sandwiches, but you did it anyway." "I didn't like butter on meat sandwiches, and I don't like grapes in my chicken salad."
Well, I'll tell you what, you just call up Good Housekeeping and you tell them that they don't know what they're doing. I'll bet they'd appreciate that. They'd probably give you a free subscription. They probably would.
Silence.
Then I say, listen, how are you, Ma? Louise is worried about you.
Me?
Yes. Well, I have no idea why. You're the one she should be worried about.
She said she thought you were depressed.
She should know better than that. I don't get depressed. I'm absolutely fine. I sit back in my chair.
Oh, why not? Why don't you get depressed?
She stares at me wide-eyed.
Why don't you? I mean, everybody does once in a while. Everybody should once in a while. It can be good for you to feel bad.
She takes a bite of her sandwich.
This is delicious.
You know? Seriously, Ma.
She puts down her sandwich, looks at me.
You want to know why I don't get depressed? I'll tell you why. I never saw the point of it, Sam. I don't delve into things too deeply. It's better that way.
How would you know? You don't have any means of comparison. You glide along like...
You never even... When did you ever let anyone get close to you? I mean, really close to the real you.
She looks at me, a long-lasting thing that makes me feel as though I'm being slowly drunk.
Finally, I don't know how you can say that, Sam, she says quietly.
Well, it's true. You have this... It's impenetrable. Your constant, crazy cheerfulness. It's an insult. It keeps people from you.
She nods slowly. Then there is the ridiculous sound of the kitchen cuckoo clock signaling the half hour. I look at my watch. I have to go. Oh, Ma, I'm sorry. I'm sorry I said that. I'm just... I don't know. I guess I needed to yell at someone. I'm sorry.
I stand, reach for my coat. She takes our plates to the sink, starts running water.
I'm really sorry. I'm a jerk.
It's all right. You've got a lot on your mind. I know you're not yourself.
I stand watching her. I don't know what to do. I've got to go.
I'll see you later.
Sam, she shuts off the water, turns to face me. You'll find this out when Travis gets older. But your children never really grow up for you.
I start to say something, then stop.
You protect your children. You must always protect them.
From what, Ma?
From everything that's sad or wrong or scary. I mean, you try. That's what you're supposed to do.
But that's not what I believe. I believe children are entitled to the truth.
How much truth, Sam?
I don't answer.
What is the answer?
I know I embarrass you. I've always known that. But I have to get through life in my own way. It pleases me to be happy, and it pleases plenty of other people, too. Yes, it does. Louise, for example.
Are you serious?
Louise does not have a problem with me. She loves me very much. She may not tell you that, but she does.
I stare at my mother's carefully made-up face, and suddenly I see that same face many years ago, shortly after my father died, when she came out of the bathroom after having been in there for a very long time.
Now, she said.
I was sitting in the hall spinning jacks, and I looked up at her.
I think this style is much better, don't you?
She showed me some modifications she'd made to her hairdo, and I nodded, then returned to my jacks. What occurs to me now is that what my mother had been doing all that time was weeping, with astonishing quiet, and that when she was done, she'd washed her face, fixed her hair, put on lipstick, and then gone out to the kitchen. She'd turned the radio on low and made dinner so that it would be ready when it always was. And then she smiled and chatted empty-headedly or fussed at her daughters all during dinner, preempting any kind of real conversation, preempting any questions, and then she put her daughters to bed, still smiling, still dispensing random advice about this and that. And her daughters squirmed and rolled their eyes and felt their love lessen year by year, eroded by embarrassment, by a terrible, defeating kind of resignation that told them she would never be different. But what did Veronica do after she put us to bed? I wonder now, and I imagine a mother who took a mask off her face, then pushed hard into a pillow to weep for the loss of her husband, for the loss of the life she was supposed to have, for the only man she ever, I actually gasp thinking this now, loved. And it comes all at once to me, it comes at this instant, that my mother simply lost too much and repaired herself in the only way she was able. That in fact, she is continuing to repair herself, hour by hour, the pendulum of the cuckoo clock swinging in the light and the dark of all the days that have passed since my father died at this same brown wooden kitchen table. "Ma," I say, "I'm so sorry."
"For what, honey?"
There it is, the vacant brightness in her eyes, evidence of the invisible amputation that I have missed forever until now. She comes over and hugs me.
"Don't be sorry, I'm just fine. You tell Louise that, all right?"
"Yes," I say, "I'll tell her." And then, "Want to come to dinner tomorrow night?"
"Not tomorrow, I've got a date with a new fella."
She makes a get-up sound, a Charlton Heston look-alike, and I'm not kidding. "It's his son that I want you to meet, by the way."
"Okay."
She blinks.
"Really?"
"Yeah."
"Well, he is divorced, honey, a couple of times. Well, three. But he doesn't have any children, and he..."
"It's all right, I'll meet him." I slide my coat on. My arms feel unreal to me, sewn on. At the door, my mother says, "His name is Jonathan. J-O-N-A-thon. That kind. I'll have him call you."
"Okay."
"Don't rush anything now. This is just for fun."
"Ma."
My mother waits expectantly. One eyebrow has been drawn in slightly lower than the other, and it is nearly more than I can bear.
"I won't rush," I say. "Don't worry."
As I am stepping into the car, my mother leans out the door to call.
"How about if I come for dinner Thursday night?"
"Fine," I call back, realizing I forgot I asked her. Chapter 11. I am standing at the living room window watching for King's car. He is taking me to the employment agency he works for. "You don't need any experience for lots of these jobs," he'd said. "Alive and ambulatory. You're in their A-plus bracket." Lydia, who is on the sofa with a large print novel, sighs and puts her book down.
"What?" I say. "Are you grinding your teeth? Is that the noise I'm hearing?"
"I'm not grinding my teeth. I could have sworn."
"Well, I'm not."
"Are you nervous?"
"No."
I cross my arms tightly over my chest.
"It's hard, I know, but you'll be all right."
I go to sit beside her. "It's just, I've never felt so, I mean, I think about getting a job at McDonald's, and I worry that I won't be able to work the cash register."
"Oh, I think you could probably manage that."
I check my watch, get up to look out the window again.
"He's not due quite yet," Lydia says. "Don't worry, he won't be late. He's not the type."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean, he cares. He pays attention. He's not the type to disappoint."
"Right, as opposed to the type I married." Lydia hesitates, then says,
"I wonder if I might ask you something."
I turn to face her. "Of course."
"Did you think life would be easy all the time?"
"No."
"Are you sure?"
A horn honks, and I jump up.
"Here he is. I'll see you later."
"Good luck, and take your time. I'll be here when Travis gets home. I'll have him help me make dinner. He's quite good at making meatballs." "Thank you." "And Lydia?"
"Yes."
"I really didn't think it would be easy all the time. I just didn't know how weak I was."
"Well, that's where you're wrong."
She pulls her cardigan up higher over her shoulders, resettles her glasses on her nose. "You'll see." King waits for me while I fill out the application and have an interview. Then he takes me to a diner. He orders coffee. I order the cheeseburger platter deluxe.
"So," he says.
"So it was easy." I shed my coat, toss it into the corner of the booth. I feel good. I feel great.
"I told you."
The woman who interviewed me looked like she was 12.
"Ah, the senior staff member then.
They said they'd call as soon as tomorrow."
"They could.
Maybe we'll get a job doing something together.
I'm moving mattresses tomorrow, warehouse."
"Oh, never mind." My burger is delivered and I take a bite, then say around it, "I told my mother I'd go out with someone she knows."
"Oh, yeah?"
"Yeah, I wanted to do something for her."
"What about you? Is it something you want to do?"
I salt my French fries, eat one, two.
"Not really."
"You might have a good time."
I shrug, offer a fry to him, which he refuses. I wonder if he's dieting. If he lost weight, he'd be a very attractive man. But I would miss something. I've grown accustomed to his size. It's comforting to me.
Your husband was an asshole, King says suddenly. I look up, stop chewing. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that.
It's okay, it's true.
It's hard to hear criticism about someone you love, though. I know that. I start to say I never really loved David, then don't.
In the car on the way home, I tell King, I feel so comfortable with you.
Yes.
I mean, from the very beginning, I felt as though we were friends. I shiver a little. The car is cold. He turns up the heat, reaches behind him for a blanket, tosses it on my lap.
Me too.
And then, you know, I've just started to date out of the personals, so don't feel bad about your mother fixing you up.
Really? Have you had good experiences?
Mostly, I'm too fat. It is mild, without rancor, the way he says it. I tell them on the phone that I'm heavy. They usually say it's no problem. But then I show up, and most of the time they get that look, you know, that look.
So what do?
He shrugs. I tell them never mind. I say it's okay. I go home and read, or go to the movie by myself.
Well, they ought to give you a chance.
Yeah, King says, smiling, and suddenly I see him as a little boy, home from school, innocent and hungry, holding pulpy papers in his hand that he will offer up to his mother. And then he is himself again, pulling into my driveway.
Here you are.
Thank you, I say.
Thank you.
I laugh. For what?
I don't know.
I open the car door and he says, well, I do know. I wait expectantly. And he says, I'll tell you another time.
Chapter 12. Early Saturday morning, Lydia and I are sitting at the breakfast table looking through the personal ads. We're seeing if anyone looks better than the blind date I have set up with Jonathan for tonight.
Here's one, Lydia says, squinting at the tiny print. He's 43, he's financially secure, he likes dining out, travel, and walks along the beach.
Oh, they all say that. Honest to God, read a few more. They will all say that.
What I want to know is, when I go to the beach, how come I don't see hundreds of available men walking up and down looking for women? You know, expensive sweaters wrapped around their shoulders, airline tickets in their pockets?
Well, of course, it is almost winter.
I know, but even in summer, I never see any.
Lydia considers this, frowning, fingering the handle on her teacup.
I'll bet there were some available men there. You probably just weren't really looking.
No, I say. They weren't there. There were just families yelling at their kids not to drown and teenagers walking around like billboards, acting as if their bodies would never change. They're so oblivious to the fact that they'll get older. Sometimes I want to grab them and say, hey, I used to look just like you. Ha, ha, ha.
Yes, Lydia says. That's what I want to say to you sometimes.
She sips her tea.
My God, of course that must be true. Of course it must. What's a little cellulite next to a face full of deep wrinkles? What's a face full of deep wrinkles next to infirmity? When does the time come when you stand in front of your grown-up woman's mirror and feel contentment for what you see? Ever?
Well, now look at this, Lydia says, pointing to the ads. This really does sound good. He's an artist, a painter. He has season tickets to the ballet. He likes big dogs. Oh, but he's a much older gentleman. He's more for me.
You don't need anyone, I say ruefully. Lydia is wearing a gift from Thomas, an ultra-soft navy blue robe with a thin line of red trim. In the pocket of the robe had been a folded-up sonnet about sleep, one of Thomas's favorites that he had copied out for Lydia in his tall, back-slanted script.
I know, Lydia says, smiling. In fact,
what?
Well, maybe I shouldn't say this yet. I'm not absolutely certain after all, but Thomas and I are thinking about getting married.
I sit back in my chair, wordless. I see Lydia at the altar, her veil being lifted, and there is Thomas, his face illuminated with love and hope, bending down to kiss her.
What do you think? Lydia asks.
Well, what about me? I think it's wonderful, Lydia. I just
That's really wonderful. When? Well, at first we thought June, of course, but then considering our ages, Thomas thought maybe we'd better just go ahead and do it as soon as possible. She looks meaningfully over the top of her glasses at me.
So, you'll be moving out then?
Yes, I'll be moving into his place.
Damn,
I'll have to find another roommate. I recall seeing a sign only yesterday on the bulletin board at a bookstore. Female college student seeks room, can teach Japanese. At the time, I'd thought idly of calling her, thinking it would be nice to have one more roommate. The heating bill has been much higher than I thought it would be. Now I think I'd better go to the bookstore as soon as it opens this morning and get the number, have the woman over for an interview right away. Might be nice having a young Japanese woman around. That black hair, that soft voice. I am making terrible assumptions, I know. I am possibly even being racist, but I can't help it. The woman will sit at the kitchen table in a beautiful turquoise kimono, cut an orange into 6 even slices. And then I look over at Lydia, and my fantasy dissolves into regret. I have loved sharing a house with her. I like it when she sits at the kitchen table, slowly folding towels while I make dinner. I like seeing the strip of light coming from under her door when I go to bed at night. It makes me, however irrationally, feel safe. We occasionally watch old black and white movies together late at night, sighing with equal implausibility over young Robert Mitchum, over Clark Gable. We have begun to talk like girlfriends, to reveal the small and intimate things that one collects like cards for a good hand on the way to forging a real friendship. I know that Lydia likes pea soup with the ham bone in, gin rummy, the jolting thrill of cold sheets at night, a certain brand of outrageously expensive cold cream that comes in a frosted glass jar with a pink top. She will only wear silk slips. In some ways, in such a short length of time, Lydia has become a better friend to me than Rita. But now she is going to leave. I try smiling, but I feel terrible, abandoned again. Perhaps this will be a condition like anemia, chronic abandonment. It won't be for a while, Sam. I want to give you at least a month's notice. And as I said, I'm really not completely sure yet. Well, why wouldn't you do it? I ask. The phone rings and I ignore it. Why wouldn't I? Oh, I don't know. I kind of like my independence. And to tell you the truth, I've really enjoyed living here with you. I feel as though I've gotten younger in a way. And I adore Travis. We've become real pals. I know, I say. Travis has been teaching Lydia to play his latest computer game. Last night, jealous, I stood in the hallway with the laundry basket on my hip, peeking into Travis's bedroom. I saw Lydia sitting beside Travis, listening to him tell her things he had never told me. The only thing he has told me recently is that Lydia's bird recognizes him, calls him by name whenever he speaks to it, whereas every time I say anything to it, the bird falls silent. I can't imagine a parakeet saying, "Travis," but never mind. I go over to the sink, rinse out my cup. I do wonder, Lydia says, if getting married at my age isn't awfully foolish. I don't think so, I say, and I hope if you have a wedding, I'll be invited. Oh, of course, you and Travis and that King fellow. I'd like him to come too, very pleasant man, and a wonderful cook. True, on a few occasions now, King has made dinner for all of us. He never measured anything, always succeeded in making something we all, even Travis, liked. Last time, King presented us with chicken roasted with some exotic herbal combination, tiny new potatoes, green beans, and a chocolate mousse pie we had all marveled at. You could make this, King told me that night, watching me eat a huge second piece. I'll teach you. He tells me that all the time, that I can do things. Sometimes I want to say, it's all right, you don't have to say that, I'm not so sad today. But I never do. Instead, I save his confidence in me as though his words were silver dollars, knotted in a silk scarf and kept hidden in a dresser drawer. Travis comes into the kitchen, still sleepy-looking at 10:30, and heads for the cereal cabinet. Can Mike Oberlin come over today? He squats down to reach for Cheerios, his back to me. He needs a haircut. His pajamas are wrinkled. Between the bottoms and top, I can see his winter white skin. He reminds me at this moment of a bird newly hatched from the shell. Were he younger, I would pull him onto my lap and hug him, bury my nose in his neck to breathe in the rich scent of child sleep. Instead, I set out the milk for him, get him a bowl and a spoon, tell him of course Mike can come over. I relish these small returns to normality. I'll be wonderful to Mike. "Wow, your mom's cool," Mike will say, lying on Travis's bed with his shoes on, about which I will say nothing, not one word. "Yeah, I guess," Travis will answer, full of pride. Travis fixes his cereal, then heads for the family room and the television. He'll turn on MTV, I know, and I feel the usual stab of regret that he's not watching Sky King or Fury instead of women's breasts shoved into leather brassieres, ravaged-looking young men howling out sociopathic lyrics while they walk around sets that look like Armageddon. I've decided to let Travis watch occasionally instead of making it more alluring by disallowing it. Anyway, as he has repeatedly pointed out, everyone else watches it. He has to. When he told me that, I imagined him sitting in the lunchroom at school with other boys who were discussing the latest videos. "You see Madonna air humping?" I imagined one boy saying and Travis answering, "Yeah," and giving the thumbs up sign. This depressed me, so I revised the scene to have Travis respond by saying, "Air humping? What's that?" and then finishing the lunch I made him, all of it. Lydia folds the personals, drinks the last of her tea. "I'd better get moving. Catherine and I are going over to the mall to do a little shopping." She goes to the sink to wash her cup, dries it, and puts it back in the cupboard. I put my mug in the dishwasher, then go to pick up the message on the machine. It is Jonathan, confirming our date for the evening, telling me that the restaurant he decided on is pretty fancy, just so I know what to wear. I hate this. I call King, leave him a message telling him what time to come over. He's going to babysit for Travis. Lydia won't be home and David is out of town on business. Probably not alone. "Dad has a girlfriend," Travis told me, last time he came back from spending the weekend with David. "Really?" I asked, and Travis nodded. "Did you meet her?" "Yeah, that's how I know." "What's she like?" He shrugged. "I don't know." "Well, what does she look like?" I asked, to which Travis again replied, "I don't know," in an irritatingly dreamy voice that made me feel like shaking him. "Does she have blonde hair?" He thought for a moment, then said, "Red. It's long." "Uh-huh," I said. "Well, that's all right. It's all right, don't you think, for him to have a girlfriend?" Travis didn't answer, and I didn't ask any more questions. Chapter 13. At 5 PM, I head for Travis's room to tell him it's time for Mike's mother to come. They'd better wait downstairs. She'd called saying she was in a hurry. Outside the door, I hear the sound of muffled giggling. I smile, wait. I want to eavesdrop a little. Sometimes I write down the good stuff in a journal I've been keeping since Travis was born. Apparently, they are on the phone with someone. "Tell her you'll meet her at the movie," Travis says, and I hear Mike say, "Okay, so why don't I meet you right outside the movie, 7 o'clock tonight?" He hangs up and the boys begin giggling louder. Oh, what is this? I think they're too young for dating. Then I hear Travis say, "How long do you think she'll wait?" "Probably about 500 hours, Mike says. They laugh again louder, little hyenas. And I understand that Mike has no intention of going, that whoever the girl is will be standing there, holding her plastic purse and not looking around anymore after a while, just standing there. I push the door open, announce brusquely to Mike that his mother is coming, he should get downstairs and wait for her. Then pointing to a baggie full of chocolate chip cookies, "Are those the cookies I made?" "Yeah." His collar is turned up in the back and I want to stomp forward and turn it down, hard. "Give them back to me," I say. "Mom," Travis yells. "Sorry, I need them." Mike hands me the bag. He looks quickly at Travis, then away. He will tell his mother on me, no doubt. "You know Mrs. Morrow," he'll say, "the one whose husband dumped her? She's nuts now." Well, the hell with him, the hell with his mother. Later, I will make Travis call that little girl back and set her straight. Then I'll tell him that he'd better learn some things about how to treat girls, starting right now. I can't wait to give him this lecture. If he interrupts me, I will take away MTV from him for 100 years, and what a pleasant century it will be. "Whoa, you look great," King says when I open the door. Well, I say, thank you. I am wearing a cobalt blue dress, belted tightly at the waist. It's short, shows off my legs, and the color has always been good for me. I do look nice, even if the weight I've gained recently is making the belt feel like a pretty instrument of torture. I have makeup on for the first time in weeks, and I've fancied up my hair with hot rollers. Joy is at each of my pulse points. King, dressed in a gray sweat outfit, is carrying two videos. Terminator 1 and 2, he says. Do you mind? I don't care what he watches. I'm mad at him. How come? Oh, long story, I say, and look away. Because the truth is, I realize now, I overreacted. I don't know all the circumstances. Maybe the boys had some legitimate complaint against this girl. Maybe she had done something really terrible to them. But if so, they could have handled it another way. It's David I was punishing, not them. Where are you going tonight? King asks. Oh, out to dinner, some fancy place. I don't want to go. I'm a nervous wreck. This feels so silly. Dating, what a dumb word. You'll relax after you meet him. It's hard, this part, the part right before they ring the bell. Doesn't feel great to be on the other side of the door either. Take it from me. Why don't you come and sit down with me? I follow him into the kitchen, sit at the table opposite him. It feels so strange sitting in this homiest of places wearing heels and sheer-to-the-waist pantyhose, and a dress I have to be careful not to spill on. I hope there's nothing smeared on the seat of the chair, making a mark to which my date will point later, saying, I believe there's something on your dress. The kitchen light is such a nice yellow when it's dark out like this. It's so cozy. Why can't I just stay home, change into my own sweatpants, and watch movies with the boys, make some popcorn drenched with butter, loaded with salt? Why do I have to walk around outside in high heels, feeling the bitter November wind at my ankles as though it is sniffing them, asking, "Are you crazy? Why don't you have socks on?" It's supposed to flurry tonight. Maybe it could get bad. I'd better stay home.
I'll bet I know what you're thinking, King says.
What? You're thinking of what you could possibly do to stay home.
I am not.
Listen, forget about it. Stop thinking about what might happen. Just sit here and let's talk about anything.
Okay.
I fold my hands before me, try to think of something to say. My mind is absolutely blank. I am an imbecile. When my date tries to make conversation with me, I will only smile vacantly, like a Cupid doll with feathers sticking out of her brain. Finally, King says, "So, got any job prospects for Monday?"
"Oh, I'm glad you said that. I meant to tell you. They did call me. I can have my choice, laundromat attendant or receptionist, for a whole week."
"Take the laundromat thing."
"You're kidding."
"No."
"But isn't that kind of humiliating?"
He smiles. "Why?"
"I don't know. Have you done it?"
"No, but I would. I like those kinds of jobs." I nod, then say gently, "Didn't you ever think maybe you'd like to go to college, you know, get a good education, some great job?"
"I went to college."
"Oh, I'm sorry, I just assumed. It's okay."
"Where did you go?" I ask casually.
I'll need to be careful, tell him without seeming insincere that it doesn't make any difference, really, where you go to school.
"MIT, he says, and then, "Do you have any popcorn?"
I point to the cupboard over the refrigerator.
"MIT?"
"Yeah."
"The Massachusetts Institute of Technology?"
"Yeah."
He pulls down a package of popcorn, brings it over to the microwave.
"What did you study?"
"Astrophysics."
"And did you finish?"
"Sure."
"So, why do you walk dogs?"
He turns around to look at me.
"I like it."
Travis comes into the kitchen, sits down at the kitchen table.
"Hi, King," he says pleasantly.
This is so when he's nasty to me, it will have a better effect.
"Hi, Travis," King says. "Want some popcorn?"
"Sure."
He stares sullenly at me. I stare back, then make a face at him. I'm good at this. I used to sit at the kitchen table with Louise, fighting silently behind our mother's back.
Oh, the venomous stares we mastered, the contemptuous fury we could communicate in a split second's time.
The doorbell sounds, and I start so hugely my hands fly apart.
"Mom," Travis says.
"I'm going to throw up right now." "I'll get it," Travis says, and then from the hallway he yells, "Mom, it's that guy for you. He has flowers."
"Oh, God," I think.
I look helplessly at King. Well, he says, where do you keep the vases?
Chapter 14. When Jonathan and I enter the restaurant, I hear a piano playing softly. In the far corner, I see a smallish black man, dressed in a tuxedo and a crooked black bow tie, seated behind a baby grand. He is older, his hair gray, his face lined. He is smiling, sadly, I believe, and playing elegant background music. He sees me staring and nods at me. I know, I feel like telling him, I don't want to be here either. Let's go somewhere. I can wear jeans and you can play what you want. 2 for 8 o'clock, Jonathan tells the maitre d', who looks as though he's been stuffed into his suit. Were he not so smug-looking, I would feel sorry for him. Certainly, Mr. Schaefer, the man says, checking a name off in a cream-colored register. Right this way. Oh, fine, Mr. Schaefer. Jonathan's been here 100 times. No wonder he's perfectly relaxed. I never saw the point in going out to fancy restaurants. It's not that I don't appreciate good food. I love good food. But why go to all this trouble? Why put on fancy clothes to eat? I follow the maitre d' to the table, Jonathan close behind me. I don't like having him so close behind me. Probably hairpins are sticking out of my French twist. I could have runs in the back of my nylons. I forgot to check. I have never learned to walk quite right in heels. I always wobble. I have never liked dressing up for any reason, and I will never, ever do this again. It's my life. Plus, I hate Jonathan, who can't even be honest enough to spell his name with an H. Stupid prep school name. The name of a man who walks around flinging his hair back off his forehead, talking endlessly about sailing. When my chair is pulled out for me with a flourish, I sit down furious. What is the point of all this formality? Why should my chair be pulled out for me? Do I look incapable of pulling a chair out for myself? Why doesn't the maitre d' pull the chair out for Jonathan? Why must it always be the women doing these circus tricks? And then, watching the maitre d' pull the chair out for Jonathan, I think, oh, never mind. Well, here we are. Only a couple more hours to go. I smile tightly at Jonathan, then at the white-coated waiter who has glided smoothly as a swan to my side. I know his type. He will pour coffee, starting low, and then let his arm rise up spectacularly high as though the stream should be roughly comparable to Niagara Falls. And he will sneak up on us, using ridiculous silver tongs to place sculpted pieces of butter on our bread plates, and everything he does will be done with an air of distant disapproval. Good evening, he says, and I jump. Oh, good evening, I say, and wish so much that I were at home, asleep. Would you care for a cocktail? The waiter asks. Would I care for a cocktail? I would care for about 90 cocktails. Yes, a glass of white wine, please, I say. I hate white wine. I like red wine, out of jelly glasses, like the gangsters in movies. But I think it might be wrong, red wine. Lightning fast, the waiter recites a list of choices for white wine. Show off. I'll have the first one, I say. The first one you said. The waiter nods, turns to Jonathan. A gin martini, Jonathan says. Bombay Sapphire, extra dry, extra cold, 2 olives, straight up. Very good, sir. Excuse me, I say, and when the waiter turns to me, I tell him, I'd like to change my order to what he's having. Certainly. Sorry. It's quite all right. He glides away. I smile at Jonathan. So? I clear my throat, look down at my purse. What's in here? A lipstick, some tissues, a few bucks. Are you nervous? Jonathan asks. I look up quickly, laugh, and then, to my absolute horror, snort. Tomorrow I will kill my mother. Me too, Jonathan says. Pardon? I'm nervous too. No, you're not. He smiles. I assure you I am. I'm just sneaky about it. So do you... What makes you think I'm nervous? Is that why you asked that question, because you think I am nervous? It'll get better in a few minutes, Jonathan says, honest. Right. I lean forward a little, try to relax my hands, which have been clutching each other rigor mortis style. He is handsome, there's no doubt about that. I wish I could freeze time so that I could stare at him for as long as I want. Thus far, I have taken polite little looks. He is blonde, his hair nicely streaked, his eyes a deep blue.
He wears a pair of tortoiseshell glasses that I like very much. He is tall, slim. What the hell is the matter with him that he has to have blind dates? Our drinks are delivered and we both take a sip. I lean back in my chair.
See, Jonathan says, it's better already, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Inside my pointy shoes, my toes uncurl. It is over dessert that Jonathan brings up Veronica. According to my father, she's quite an extraordinary woman.
Oh, yes, I say, she really is.
I take another bite of creme brulee. It is delicious. It is so delicious. It makes me happy. The rough, burnt sugar surface, the smooth insides. Maybe I'll have another one. If I can have two martinis, I can have two desserts. The silver spoon I'm using is so elegant, so right. Look at these thick linen tablecloths, these lovely ivory-colored candles with their gentle flickering flames, their flattering glow. I should go back to Tiffany's and get some candle holders. I was right when David first left to want to live this way. This is the way to live. I take another bite, rub my tongue against the roof of my mouth. It feels wonderful. I look at Jonathan's mouth, sexy, deep inside me, a pleasant stirring. I want to kiss him. Oh, I want to kiss him. Later I will kiss him. Or now. I stand up, go over to his side of the table. I just want to do something, I say. I bend down and kiss him lightly on the mouth. Then I go back to my side of the table. There, I say. Well, thank you, he says. That was nice. And then, are you all right?
I'm fine, I sigh, rest my head in my hand. I wonder where my shoes are.
Well, they couldn't have gone too far. I'm afraid we've had a bit too much to drink, he says, but his voice is kind and rich, and he makes our overindulgence sound stylish.
Yes, I say, we certainly have.
I don't usually. Oh, me either. What friends we are. Able so soon to complete each other's sentences. You know, Jonathan, I say, you are a very good-looking man, and I would like to kiss you again.
Well, he says, likewise.
Should we do it here, or should we go and make out in the car with the heater turned up? I am quite pleased with my forwardness. This is really very good for me. I need to do more of this. Yes, I do. Why don't I get the check, he says. Oh, he's paying. What a wonderful, wonderful man. So,
Gregory Peckish, I feel for my shoes, slide into them, and then stand, only a bit unsteadily.
I'll just go to the bathroom, I tell him. I should have said powder room. That would evoke the image of me sitting before a beautiful gold mirror, a vase of fresh flowers nearby, freshening my makeup, rather than sitting on a toilet. Just want to powder my nose, I add, lightly touching his shoulder as I pass by him. There, all fixed. See, life is easy. Full of choices and quick remedies if only you look. There's no reason in the world to mourn one relationship when another is so easy to find. Why, Jonathan is reading the same book as I am. After I use the toilet, I stand before the mirror, put on lipstick, then blot it. I arrange my hair with my fingers, pull down on a strand to make it rest near one eye. I put on a little more eyeliner, then a touch more blush. I have always been a champion kisser, and I have a feeling Jonathan is too. I can't wait to get back to him. I am a woman in my 40s, and I know what's up. I can do whatever I want. I take in a deep breath, straighten my belt, head back to the table. This urge is growing stronger and stronger. Well, good. It's good. I'd thought I was broken. I'm not broken. I am an attractive woman, out with my new friend Jonathan, who is a very attractive man. My mother is quite good at this fixing-up business. I will thank her. Yes, I will send her a pretty little bouquet, and on the card will be, thanks. No, more. On the card will be, you were absolutely right. No, not that much. Well, something will be on the card to tell my mother what a good matchmaker she turned out to be. Maybe I'll call Stuart Gardner, that guy who called before, the other one my mother recommended. Maybe I'll just be a dating fool, have a stable of studs, a blonde, a brunette, and a redhead. None of them with male pattern baldness. None of them on Viagra. When I arrive back at the table, Jonathan looks up at me. Ready? Oh, yes, I say. Yep. Of course, we do not make out in the car. We make out in his bed. I'm in my 40s, and so is he, and we have admitted to each other that we have, in our lifetimes, had our share of back trouble. So here I am lying on the bottom, and here he is lying on the top, and he is kissing me, and I could not be more content. On the weekends, when David has Travis, I will live here, and Jonathan will bring me champagne when I lounge in the tub after we make love. He will bring me champagne with a strawberry floating in it, and he will read to me from a book of poetry by Pablo Neruda. He unzips my dress, and I panic for a moment, wondering about the state of my bra, then remember that it's a push-up, a nice one, and I'm eager for him to see it. It's got lots of lace. I feel him pulling my dress down slightly. Then he stops, kisses my neck to make for a pleasingly painful pause. The man is a master. I should pay him. He pulls my dress down farther, kisses my collarbones, moves down, stops just above my breasts. I pull lightly on his hair, inadvertently moan. He pulls my dress down to my waist and kisses my breasts through my bra. And now, finally, there are his smart fingers undoing my bra and his mouth at last on my bare skin. He runs his hand up my thigh, and I think I might burst with lust. And then somehow my bra is over my face, the underwire poking into my right eye. Hold on, I say, laughing, and start to pull away. Oh, no, he groans. Don't. No, I just want to... Wait a second. What I'll do is just take everything off. Well, maybe not everything. No, everything. But he is squeezing me tightly, holding me down, kissing me harder than before. It is not entirely unpleasant, but then suddenly it is. Jonathan, I say, wait a minute. He pulls back, his eyes narrowed. What the fuck is this? You want it just as much as I do. I breathe out an astonished laugh. Feel myself descend with a lurch into instant sobriety. I just forget it. The hell with it. He sits up at the edge of the bed, turns on the light. I regret that his clothes are still on while I am in a state of undress that is sexy no more. No, not any more. I pull down my bra, fasten it, sit up, and pull my dress onto my shoulders. With some difficulty, I zip it. Jonathan takes one sharp look at me, then looks away. He pulls a pack of cigarettes out of the bedside stand drawer, lights one. You smoke, I say, and the whole card house falls down, down, down. Outside, I look up at the night sky, blink back tears. It's too cold to cry. It's clear, the moon full, the stars like pinholes in black velvet. On the lawns I walk past are the reaching patterns of moon shadows, cast by the bare limbs of trees. I walk carefully, slipping often. God damn men, I say out loud. They're all pigs, all of them. But Travis, he won't be a pig, I'll make sure of it. I may not ever contribute much to this world, but the one thing I will do is make sure Travis is a gentleman, a gentle man. I'm going to start paying very, very close attention to him and shape him so that he will come out like a gay man, but be straight. Unless, of course, he wants to be gay. But it doesn't look good for that. Signs of inattentiveness and carelessness abound. I slip again and this time fall gracelessly onto my side. My purse slides a few feet ahead of me, then stops as though it is looking back, playing a game. I start to get up, but then instead turn onto my back. It's not so bad here on the sidewalk. It's restful. I move my arms and legs, checking for pain. Nothing terribly wrong. Nothing broken, anyway. The door to a nearby house opens. I see a yellow rectangle of light, then the silhouette of a woman in a bathrobe leaning out. Hello, she calls. Are you all right, miss? I struggle to my feet. I'm fine, I say. Liar. I just fell. I saw. My goodness. Well, it's slippery, you know. You'd fall, too, if you were out here wearing 3-inch heels. The woman closes the door. Oh, I hadn't meant to sound so defensive. I should have been nicer. Ask the woman to use her phone to call a cab. I brush snow off my coat. Funny, I'm not so cold now, and continue walking. A car slows down, and I quicken my step. It is Jonathan come to beg forgiveness. Well, he is not forgiven. Then the car pulls over, and I see that it is not Jonathan. It is a bunch of teenage boys. The window rolls down, and the boy riding shotgun leans out, starts to say something. Then, seeing me more clearly, he says nothing, rolls the window back up, and the car drives away. Pigs. When I finally arrive home, I let myself in the back door, go into the kitchen, and upend the vase of roses Jonathan brought me into the garbage. Red for romance, right? Hello, King calls. He comes into the kitchen and leans against the door jamb, watching me. I rinse the vase out, shove it back into the cupboard. Didn't go so well, huh? Ha! I fling wet hair off my face, kick off my heels. What happened? Well, for one thing, I ended up walking home. Really? Yes, that's right. I walked home. And let me tell you, that was the best part of the evening. You walked all the way home from the restaurant? I looked up from unbuttoning my coat. Yes, well, no, it was from his apartment, all right? It was from there, but it was still far. What happened, Sam? I burst into tears. And when King comes toward me, I hold up my stained evening bag to keep him away. No, I say, don't. I weep silently for a moment, then stop suddenly and say, I am sorry to tell you this, King, because you're a man, but men are assholes, every single one of you. This can never change. Well, not every one of us. Yes, you are. I'm sorry, but yes, you are. You must be freezing. Go change out of those clothes. Then come down here and I'll make you some tea. I don't want any tea, and I don't believe I want to talk. Thank you for babysitting. I mean, I'm grateful. I am. But I do not want to talk to you. He shrugs. Okay. He starts for the closet in his coat. I regret myself instantly. King has never been anything but kind to me. None of this is his fault. Wait, I say. I'm sorry. Don't leave. I'll go change. In my bedroom, I throw my dress on the floor, then kick it into the corner. I pull out a pair of jeans and a faded blue sweatshirt from my dresser drawer, start to put them on, then throw them on the floor as well. From another drawer, I pull out plaid flannel pajama bottoms and a long-sleeved t-shirt. I change into them, add thick socks and my old battered terry cloth robe. In the bathroom, I take off my makeup and contacts and put my glasses on. On my way back downstairs, I peek into Travis's room, then tiptoe in to watch him sleep. I want to kiss his forehead, and I want to wake him up and say fiercely between my teeth, "Listen, Buster, don't you ever treat a woman the way I was treated tonight." I do neither. Instead, I stand beside him, cotton-headed, realizing the alcohol hasn't quite worn off yet. In the family room, a grainy black-and-white movie is on TV. A dinosaur is shaking a skyscraper around in his mouth, his eyes rolling unconvincingly from side to side. People cling to the side of the building like ticks. When King sees me, he turns off the television, folds his hands over his stomach, waits. I think this was date rape, I say, finally. Almost. He starts to say something, then stops. I mean it. I'm sorry. Well, what did I expect? This is what always happens one way or another. Come on, Sam. It's not what always happens. You know that. I stand still for a moment, wondering if I have enough energy for a good debate. He reaches forward, pulls my glasses off my face, and polishes them with his sweatshirt. You can't even see, he tells me. Can too. I watch as he rubs the glasses, holds them up to the light, rubs them again, and then places them carefully back on. The gesture is so tender, it makes me start crying again for all that is not tender in the world. Was Travis good? I ask, finally, through my tears. Yeah, King says gently. Travis was fine. And then, you know, I've never been too good at fighting, but I could go over there and sit on the guy for you. Where does he live? That would be great, I say, laughing, imagining the scene. The elegant Jonathan would be flattened cartoon-like beneath King. Then I stop laughing, feel the tail end of my drunkenness wash over me like a mild flu. I realize I am not particularly capable of anything. King, I say, could you just stay here for a while just until... Yeah, sure. Okay, good. The phone rings. Who's calling so late, I say,
And then, of course, no. It's him, the bastard. I glare at the phone. King picks it up, says hello. Then, yes, she's here. He looks over at me. Do you want to?
No!
She'd rather not, King says. Then turning slightly away from me. Probably you shouldn't call her anymore. That'd be my advice. A pause, and then, a friend. I'm her friend. I feel a rush of feelings start in my center and then spread until I can feel it in my fingertips, in my toes. Safety is what it is, and the blanket-like relief of it is awesome.
You walked home? Rita asks later that night.
Well, it wasn't that far, a couple of miles. Now that I have the outraged sympathy I was looking for, I can feign nonchalance.
It's winter. You were wearing heels.
It's not winter yet. It's still November. It's always winter in Massachusetts, except when it's August, and then it's hell. I didn't have a choice. I had to get out of there fast.
Was he really that bad? Rita asks. Maybe he was just frustrated. Maybe he thought you were teasing him.
No, he was that bad. It wasn't just nasty. It was scary.
Well, don't go out with him anymore.
I hold the phone away from myself, look at it. Don't go out with him anymore?
Great advice. Gee, and I was going to call him tomorrow, ask him to come over and maybe hold a knife to my throat.
I'll talk to you tomorrow, Rita. I'm going to sleep.
Wait, listen. I was thinking about coming out there. How would that be?
It would be great.
What do you think? I'd love to have you come out here. When?
Next week, I thought, right after Thanksgiving. I'll come on Saturday. Leave the next Saturday?
A week?
Yeah, why? Do you think that's too long?
No, well, yes, but no.
Don't worry, I'll be helpful. I'll fold all the socks. I'll chop the onions for dinner. I'll help you find a new roommate.
Don't remind me.
Maybe you'll get someone better.
Nobody would be better than Lydia. You'll see.
After I hang up the phone, I stare at the ceiling thinking Rita hasn't visited for a long time. Last time she was here, Travis didn't have any front teeth. Now he doesn't have a father, and his mother dates sociopaths. And yet, I turn off the bedside lamp, realize that nothing hurts. I take in a deep breath, as though the inhaled air will check around and let me know if that's really true. It is.
Chapter 15. Mostly you only make a change, the balding Chinese man tells me. I stare at him for a moment, uncomprehending, wondering if perhaps he is offering advice, then realize he is talking about money. I am to make change. It is 9 o'clock Monday morning, and Mr. Lee is orienting me to my job at the laundromat, leading me down a long aisle of square white washers, gigantic dryers line one wall, round glass openings like portholes. A solitary figure, a thin, older man, stands folding at a waist-high table. His movements are slow and deliberate, graceful. He is matching exactly the corners of the thin striped towel.